Wild rice, maple syrup, blackberries, and partridges are among the rich cooking traditions of the Menominee Indian Nation, which had an open attitude toward all kinds of food. Our guest author this hour shares his stories of what his family ate, plus recipes, and we will discuss why he thinks society needs to value our food more. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network. We will talk with the author of Good Seeds, a Menominee Indian food memoir, and we'll welcome your questions for him and maybe your own food stories and traditions. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Our guest is Thomas P. Corwiso, an enrolled member of the Menominee Indian Nation of Wisconsin. He's an artist, co-publisher of Manmoth Publications, and a teacher at the Kansas City, Kansas Community College. He is the author of Good Seeds, a Menominee Indian food memoir. Good morning.
Good morning.
So what led you to write this book?
It's kind of a long, convoluted story. I guess the short version and probably the more interesting version, is that basically I had a stack of personal essays that I've written over the years. My wife being a teacher of creative writing at Haskell Indian Nations University. And so it was always kind of a one-upmanship kind of thing, I guess. And one day, looking at this stack of essays that I had, I realized that most of them, and most of the better ones, actually, kind of revolved around food. And its significance is kind of a ritual and ceremony, and not tribal-wide, but among my family, among my clan, the larger extended family. And one section was included in a book by Hyde Erdwick, and she kind of encouraged me to seek publication for my essays, and eventually, they appeared at Wisconsin State Historical Society Press, and they liked it. And, here it is. Here I am.
Well, and you're actually, it's good to have you in Wisconsin via the radio. You are in Kansas now.
Right now, I'm in Lawrence, Kansas. Yes, ma'am.
Yeah, well, that's where my nephew is, too. But anyway, it's a nice community. You grew up in Keshena, the Menominee Indian Reservation, is that right?
Well, I'm not a lifelong resident of the res. I got to preface that with me saying that I am a very proud member of the Menominee Nation. But I haven't lived there, all 62 years of my life. And in my youth, because of our kind of economic circumstances, I guess, we traveled around. And so I grew up in places as diverse as Chicago, Milwaukee, Green Bay, Wausau, Fox Valley.
So tell us though, when were you in Keshena and for what period of time?
Well, I actually was born in Keshena we used to have a hospital there before the Bureau of Indian Affairs closed it when the tribe was terminated under the John Kennedy administration. And so I was born there, and I lived there till I was roughly 5 years old. Lived with my grandparents again due to my own circumstances, which I don't really want to get into. I was raised with my grandparents for a great number of years. And so I was gone then a couple of years back about 7 or 8, when I was about 7 or 8, lived again in Kishina with my grandparents, and actually went through the first the Catholic school, St. Joseph, and then the local public elementary school up till about fourth grade, and then fifth and sixth grade.
We certainly didn't have to go into any details that you didn't want to go into. I was just trying to establish that you did spend some time on the and grew up for a period of your childhood on the Menominee Indian Reservation.
Right.
In
you know, and it isn't that I'm ashamed of this by any means, but that particular story hasn't been written yet, and some of the people involved in that particular story are still around, and you know, and I don't want to put them on the spot
fine.
One way or another.
I bring this up in part because talk about how your grandparents and their culinary traditions played a role in your life growing up.
Well, my grandmother was a very strong individual, simply because she was a strong individual. And also, the Menominee tribe tends to be a matriarchal society, which it was traditionally, and there are still many holdovers in current Menominee culture of that, where the women are basically in charge of the family, and you know, my own family is no exception, and so my grandmother basically prepared the meals, and you know, when we were younger and had a much bigger family, you know, before various members went off and you know married and started their own, she would have her daughters, my aunts, help her, and so my grandmother was kind of a manager at that point. But she basically, you know, made sure that there was food in that to be served, and that the food was cooked, and that she also there was a hierarchy of who ate, you know, in what order people ate, which was a very subtle hierarchy, which I wasn't aware of until much later in my life when I really started to think about these familial relationships that existed.
Yeah, so how did that basically work?
Well, you know, I was a spoiled. I was a spoiled child, as was my brother and my sisters, and my first cousins. My grandparents were very indulgent with us, and I had assumed that my role in family meals was because I was so special, and excuse me, that really wasn't true. It was in Menominee culture, the children, you know, parents tend to indulge to their children, and children eat first, etc. You know. And the men indulge their children. They take kind of a second place.
Ah. So I talk some about what kind of meals did your grandparents, your grandmother, prepare?
Well, you know, every breakfast was kind of a big deal. And my grandmother would be at the kitchen. You know, and it sounds horrible, right? But one of the really homey things, I almost am able to visualize this, or not visualize it, but actually smell it, was the smell of cooked bacon, Pall Mall cigarette smoke, and coffee coming from down in the basement, which was where the kitchen was in our house. It was actually the first floor. We called it the basement.
Oh, it could have been my house too. So,
yeah, it was built on a hill, and so that's kind of what I woke up to every morning, and so my grandmother, again, the picture of my grandmother was constantly holding a Pall Mall cigarette and a cup of coffee, and she would do that all day long. Same kind of image.
But she would put together a humongous breakfast, right? I mean, is that a tradition?
Correct. And it was kind of, we had to do that because there's so many mouths to feed. And, you know, just this morning I was thinking about this, And I realized that one of the reasons that it was so many different types of food, for instance, we would have oatmeal, eggs, bacon, potatoes, apple pie or blueberry pie, bread. We almost always had some kind of fish that were fresh caught or fresh game. And one of the reasons that we had such a large, so many different items was because, and this was kind of epiphany for me, I just realized that we could not have afforded to eat a large breakfast of bacon and eggs, for instance.
So it was a bunch of other foods were added to that.
Correct,
yeah.
Correct.
And
so in that sense, it was, I guess it was economic, but it was that it was operating at a level that, you know, wasn't really apparent.
Yeah. Well, it made me laugh, too, though, when you said blueberry pie for breakfast. That's a deal.
We almost always had a pie for, I think my grandmother baked pies at least every day. And again, that's partly because... you know, we needed various foods, and so throughout the fall, or rather the summer and then early autumn, we would be out picking wild fruits. And so we had lots and lots of applesauce.
Mm-hmm.
And so we would have applesauce sometimes, and sometimes you would have, for a break, we would have apple pie. I mean, I love both of them. It was kind of a daily thing. I mean, I can't think of a single meal with my grandparents where we did not have some kind of pie.
Yeah, that's interesting. And was that unique to your family, or was it made into a pie just so you would be able to get the fruits of the season?
I'm not sure that it was unique to our family. I think that everybody, you know, and I'm not, you know, as much as I love my family and I think that they are unique, we probably were not so unique. I'm probably, you know, and I do consider myself part of, you know, a generation. You know, I matured during the late 60s, you know,
mm-hmm.
The summer of love. I was there.
Well, you also write in the book about how an open attitude toward all kinds of food is an important one for the Menominee people. Why is that? What is this open attitude towards all kinds of food?
Well, I think my uncle Buddy Wiso explained it best to me, and it was this. We were talking several times about Native American history, and he had a couple of different tribes in mind. One was in along the northeast coast, I think the St. Lawrence Seaway, and then another one in Louisiana. And they had existed there for thousands of years and had this great culture, and they lived on one food, and that was oysters. Mm. And they had huge shell middens that... I just got a note here. They had these huge shell middens, and they were gigantic, and it was that's what they ate, and then boom, for whatever reason, those oysters, those clams are no longer available, you know, whether the hunting grounds were denied access to their hunting grounds or what have you, but suddenly they were unavailable, and those populations simply went extinct. They died. I mean, that was the sole cultural base of their society was that one food, seafood, shellfish food.
Yes.
Shellfish. I'm not kidding about the size of these people and how many people depended upon this. I mean, and I didn't know this, but and maybe it has changed, but previous to, you know, a year ago, let's say, every single highway in Louisiana was built on a roadbed of crushed shells.
Right.
That recovered from shell middens. And so that's how long those people existed, and, you know, to the quantity, you know, of road building material and how widespread, and you know, and now boom, they're gone. So the Menominees were kind of in that respect, we were pretty lucky. We lived basically where rivers and small streams meet larger, in you know, historically the Great Lakes. We're from Menominee, Michigan. Actually, we can identify the spot where our tribe began, where it started, and so excuse me, living there really exposed us. We you know, there's a lot of different ecological niches that were available. It was the prairie basically ended about there, you know, around Green Bay. There was the Great Lakes fishing, there was small stream fishing, and along these small streams was wild rice.
And we're going to get more into wild rice in just a moment. We are talking with Thomas P. Corwiso. He is the author of Good Seeds, a Menominee Indian Food Memoir. And we will talk about wild rice and other Menominee food traditions and cooking traditions, welcoming your questions for our guest, welcoming maybe your own food traditions. Are you from one of the tribes of Wisconsin? What kind of food traditions are important to you? How do you incorporate foods like wild rice or venison or maple syrup or other foods like that into your culinary experience? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. We are talking about some Native foods, and in particular, the foods that were special to our guest, Thomas P. Corwiso, who is the author of a memoir about Menominee Indian food. It is called Good Seeds, and we're welcoming your questions for him at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Well, let's you call wild rice good seeds. Talk about its role in the Menominee tribe of Wisconsin's culture.
Well, it grows along rivers and lakes, especially along the Menominee, the Wolf River, which is where the tribe eventually ended up. And it stores very well. It's over the years, it has been, people have selected for certain characteristics in the wild rice, one of which is that it doesn't fall off in the currents, you know, as it's growing along the river, but it does fall off when you whack it with a stick, for instance. Another thing is that it was selected for, various patches of wild rice were selected for their ability to cook quickly. It's a grass. It's not a rice. It's actually a grass. And it has been used by many different peoples extensively for thousands of years. I think it's very nutritious. It's extremely, it's got a lot of fiber. And I enjoy it with just a little butter and salt and pepper in the morning for breakfast.
It is. I haven't had a lot of it, but I have had it, and I love it. And I, in fact, picked up some hand-harvested wild rice, but this was in northern Minnesota, not in Wisconsin, when I was on vacation there.
Those darn Ojibwees.
It was late summer, and
yeah,
I'm going to, I'm going to use this rice in one of the recipes that you have in the book. In fact, it was cranberries and wild rice, so it wasn't very difficult, but it sounds delicious. So
it is savory and sweet, and cranberries are not overly sweet, so savory and tangy would be a better description.
Yeah. But tell us the Menominee Indians actually take their name from the Menominee word for wild rice. What is that word?
Manamin is the word for wild rice. And the tribe is kind of an interesting history or etymology. I guess it'd even be a better way of saying it. And let me just kind of go off topic a little bit and give you the history. The Cree population, the Cree native, the Cree Indians, I guess, along the Hudson Bay, Cree in Algonquin means the people. And we are now belong to that language culture group of Algonquin. So as the Cree, as people drifted apart from the Cree nation, or as they exploited their environment, I guess, some of those bands took on particular names. And in our case, Menominee, the people of the wild rice, because we lived where wild rice was pretty abundant. The Potawatomi, on the other hand, generally lived along where trails intersect, those particular Cree people. And so their names became Potawatomi, people of the fire, because of what they took this responsibility upon themselves. But wherever there was a Potawatomi village, there was a fire there that was kept 24 hours a day for any travelers or people journeying through to warm themselves. These tribes, and you see also place names in Wisconsin that end in that kind of IEE sound, like Menominee, Potawatomi, right. Shawnee, Miami. Those are all Cree people.
Is wild rice or good seeds in particular important to the Menominee?
Well,
nation?
Again, it is to our particular tribe, the Menominee, because that's where we take our name from. And we are the Menominee Nation of Wisconsin. There is also a band of Menominees in Minnesota who actually are the Menominee Band of the Ojibwe Nation.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you, there is an effort to restore wild rice to the Bay of Green Bay, which, is in where that Menominee, Michigan area is. It disappeared after the paper mills had dumped PCBs into the Fox River in Green Bay for many years in the 20th century. While it still may take years to know if this effort is successful, I'm wondering what your reaction is to restoring the wild rice plant to the Bay of Green Bay.
I think it's a good thing. Any time that we can restore one of our major accidents, we did that intentionally, but any time that we can restore one of our major mistakes, I think is a good thing. Across society, I think all of us, are better individuals for doing that. And it's just wonderful that we are restoring natural habitat, because, once you establish natural habitat, those creatures that live there will also rebound in numbers and perhaps, never again to the level it was, back in 1860, for instance. But any positive change is welcome.
Yeah, there's been a massive, and it's an ongoing cleanup of those PCBs in Green Bay, mm-hmm. and things are looking better.
I can remember as a young man of 16 years old living along Green Bay and this, running out into the big marshes that existed at that time, where now there's a great big bridge there.
Yeah.
But playing out in the marsh grass and ending up on the bay and looking at it, and it was just so beautiful and wonderful. And it would, you know, and I'm sorry that my children, my grandchildren, haven't had that experience. And maybe, you know, my great-grandchildren will be able to have that experience. And that's a good thing.
Let's talk a little bit about fishing and what kinds of fish made it to your table.
Well, and again, I guess perhaps I was a little spoiled, or you know, and everybody kind of indulged my whims. As a kid, I you know, I was a little eating machine, and I ate anything that anybody put in front of me. Well, I was eating a bass one time, and I don't know how old I was. I you know, I must have been 4 or 5 years old, but I was eating a bass. And I got this bone stuck in my throat.
The worst.
And it just so frightened me. It just so scared me. I had a meltdown, you know, in front of, you know, 30 odd members of the family. And after that point, the family was very careful to only feed me trout, which the bones are not nearly as big and brittle as they are in a bass.
And so we
ate a lot of fish. I ate a lot of trout.
But what about the baked walleye in your book?
Well, we ate, you know, my favorite will always remain trout. Okay, and that's for some various reasons, not only the taste. I guess actually, you know, I think walleye actually tastes a little better than trout, especially for Friday night fish fries. But there's a whole mystique of catching, you know, a trout and immediately, within, you know, 20 minutes, eating that trout. And, you know, these larger walleyes that are so delicious did not really exist on those little trout streams. So I ate a heck of a lot of walleye and still do, you know, and I eat a heck of a lot of smoked trout. I'm pretty open to any kind of fish. And again, like I say, I think walleye makes a really good fish fry.
Friday we night. Are talking with Thomas Pecorwiso. He is an enrolled member of the Menominee Indian Nation of Wisconsin, and he is author of the new book, Good Seeds, a Menominee Indian Food Memoir. And we're welcoming your questions for him, your thoughts. Are there certain native foods that you incorporate into your diets? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Susie in Ellison Bay is with us. Hi, Susie.
Hi there.
Hi.
I'm calling because I've been doing a lot of research on the 1600s and the Indians that lived on the Mink River in northern Door County, which were two Potawatomi tribes, but I've done a lot of research on the fish that they ate, and they all said that the whitefish was their very favorite, and they boiled it so that they could get the oils and the whatever came up and use that as their butter. And I was wondering, this has normally been considered to be a Scandinavian invention, but it seems that from everything I've read, Nicolay was served boiled whitefish when he visited in Green Bay, and that this was definitely something that the Indians came up with, the idea of boiling fish.
Oh, so the famous Door County fish boil might have started, or did start, apparently, with the natives. Thomas?
Definitely.
Fish are, you know, to boil a fish is actually a lot easier than to fry a fish. And it seems kind of counterintuitive, but the technology to make pots are not pots, but containers that one could boil fish in was pretty widely available. I give you a story, and I don't, you know, my grandfather, who was one of the last of the real Indians, and I don't mean, you know, I'm not trying to step on anybody's toes or say anything off color here. But my grand you know, my grandfather was a, you know, old-time Indian, and he one time told me when I was pretty young, he said, you know, Tommy, the only good thing the white man brought with them was a frying pan.
Oh, boy.
And I mean, once frying pans entered into the Great Lakes region, I mean, fish boils among the tribes basically stopped a frying pan. You know, I mean, and to be honest, I, you know, I've eaten many boiled trout and boiled fish, and actually had been in Door County, you know, as a very young person, and had partaken of fish boils, right?
And I have to admit, they're not as tasty as fried fish, are they?
No, they are totally not. And so, I mean, and the point my grandfather's making, it was once we had the frying pan, you know, the hell with boiled fish.
You know, what about that, Susie's research that found that the oils from the fish were kind of used as a butter? Is that something that's a phenomenon?
I had not heard that, but it really does seem logical that that would occur. Because the fat, it would rise to the surface, and, you know, you could scoop that out and put it back in, you know, into another container where it would solidify, and you would have a animal butter.
Yeah. Well, we'll take another short break, and then we'll continue talking about our guests' families' food traditions, talking about some of the recipes from that he remembers from his childhood, talking about things like wild rice and maple syrup and blackberries and other food traditions of the Menominee. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org if you have a question for him or maybe a food tradition that you would like to share. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. The Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. We are talking with Thomas P. Corwiso, who is the author of Good Seeds, a Menominee Indian Food Memoir. And as I mentioned, after reading about some of the recipes and stories in the book, I am planning on making a wild rice and cranberry dish for our Thanksgiving meal this week. I might make some cornbread based on the recipe in Thomas's book. And you know what? I think we should. We haven't yet, but we should put on Facebook a detailed recipe. I believe we may even have that up, a detailed recipe for cornbread that was put together by, I think, the Wisconsin Historical Society Press put together this video. And we'll put that on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Love cornbread. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. How do you incorporate foods like this? Foods maybe considered native foods like corn and wild rice and maple syrup and venison or anything else. What questions do you have about Menominee food traditions? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. We have some callers coming in, but Thomas, I wanted to ask you about that that cornbread. How important was that to the table?
We had corn, you know, like apples and blueberries. We had corn almost every single day. What my grandfather grew was the multicolored corn.
Yeah,
with the blue and the, you know, the red and the yellow kernels, and they would. I'm not exactly sure his exact method to dry that, but. Again, one of the things that I grew up with was we had a large cloth sack in our coal room where it was filled with dried corn and you know, these dried multi-corn. So it was kind of a lightly purplish color. But any time that we'd want a snack, we'd go in there and grab a handful of this and eat it. He also used that corn, and they would make hull corn, which is pozole, which I guess is the Spanish or Mexican version of that. Or what is that other stuff they sell in the stores, big white kernels. But hominy, sure, yeah. And so you boil that, and the Menominees boiled it in a lye made from maple ash, and that would burn off the hard covering, and then the inside, the kernel itself, would pop flour out. And then that became the basis of soups.
Oh, yeah. Let me, it's a bread-related question from Mary in Wisconsin Rapids. Hi, Mary.
Hi. Oh, I'm glad I got to get on the air. I used to work at Head Start in Nakusa,
mm-hmm.
and we had 4 Indian children, and we actually had the opportunity to have a powwow. They were from the Ho-Chunk tribe, and one of the things that they had was fry bread, and I was wondering if his tribe also had fry bread.
Yeah, I was at a powwow too last summer, and it was fry bread was on the menu. Is that a Menominee Nation food, or what can you tell us about fry bread?
Fry bread, my personal nemesis.
Why is that?
Well, it's probably not the most healthy thing one could eat.
Yeah, it was too good to. And
but about once a year, my wife will relent and allow me to eat an Indian taco, which is basically a taco made with fry bread as a tortilla.
Oh my gosh!
Which is and then with plenty of sour cream, right?
Yeah.
And cheddar cheese topping it. Indian fry bread, it's ingrained, and I haven't seen a single tribe that doesn't have some kind of variant to frying wheat dough, and which is so funny because wheat didn't get to this country into the Americas until the middle 1800s. When it began to be grown in the Great Plains, and all of a sudden, within several years, this newly imported plant became established as a tribal food, and every tribe has their own particular variant. Like I said, among the Ho-Chunk, they use baking powder in their dough, and I'm biased. I think it makes their fry bread taste bitter. It's not as good as Menominee fry bread. But they say the same thing about Menominee fry bread. They say it's too sweet.
Interesting. Yeah. Well, I think I'd go for the sweet over the bitter myself. But I don't know, a native food, a traditional food, or was this, I don't know,
well,
modern?
Well, I would describe it as a traditional food, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Even though, the origin of this food comes from Russia. The steppes of Russia, actually, is where this particular grain was grown. Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. And it didn't get here, like I said, until, the 1850s on the Great Plains. Where they grew it extensively. So even given that origin, right, I mean, it is definitely a traditional native food, just like in this part of the country, biscuits and gravy. I mean, biscuits, right, again, wheat-based, wheat flour-based. I mean, that is definitely, many people claim that as their, one of their cultural food sources.
Yeah.
So, I think it proves my point, I haven't stated my point yet, but it does prove my unstated point that food is functional. We eat that food which grows around us, and we incorporate that food into our cultures. We build stories around that food. So every tribe has their own variant of fry bread, right? And every tribe has their own ritual of making that food, and their own ceremony of feeding, their families, their bands, their people, that food, and I think that's wonderful, and if we look at our own you know, our larger American society. That's also true among, you know, every different ethnicity I've ever come across. Hmm. I mean, we all deal with food ritually, and I guess my desire, what I'm trying to teach my own children and grandchildren, and hopefully great grandchildren from around long enough, is that not only is this ritualistic, but we should also make it ceremonial, and celebrate that food. You know, raise the value of those things that we eat. You know, and we are, as again a larger American society, we eat actually an extremely limited diet, given all of the things that are available. And I don't want to say cheapens our culture, but if we are experienced in sociology, it's called the McDonaldization of society. You know, where basically we are losing those unique things and becoming kind of bland and one kind of shade of, you know, whatever color. We are no longer unique. You know, do you remember growing up as a kid? We were taught in civics class that America is a nation of immigrants and native people that give it a particular culture and force of being almost. And now, you know, like I said, through these various processes that are going on, you know, and it's reflected in our diet, we are becoming homogenous.
Yeah. So how should we celebrate our food more than we do today? I mean, how what are you teaching your children and grandchildren? What would you like them to carry on?
My grandson told my daughter a couple of weeks ago that when he grew up, he wanted to be a chef.
Oh, neat.
He's been watching me cook. and I guess that's the key. Cook your food. You know, don't throw it in a microwave. You know, don't thaw it and then, you know, throw it in a microwave. Cook it. You know, get your hands involved in that. You know, manipulate your food. You know, feel your food. Take some pride in, you know, in how you present your food. And I think that's how we celebrate that food, you know. I mean, even you know, at some point, the Big Mac Daddy hamburger used to be a cow, and it gave its life for us. I mean, we shouldn't just eat it mindlessly. We should remember that this used to be a creature that you know, had a life, and it gave its life for us, you know.
Yeah. Well, we have Larry in Kingston with us now. Hi, Larry.
Hi. My daughter married a guy that's part Menominee Indian, and is there a special way, and is there a special type of wild rice that you get in the store? Is there a special way to cook it? Do you add vegetables or meat to it, or do you cook it slow? Do you cook it with a less amount of water? Can you cook it with milk or whatever? What's the best way to cook it?
Very good question, since I need to know how to cook this thing, this package of wild rice.
Okay.
I have.
Wild rice is, you know, an incredibly interesting plant. And again, it's a grass. It's not actually rice. I've picked it basically right at Keshena Falls, right in even the major part of the falls. It's growing right alongside in the water. I mean, it's kind of easy to find. What I like to do basically is, you know, I just make it on the stovetop with 1 cup of rice and 3 cups of water. I bring the 3 cups of water to boil, throw in, you know, a pinch of salt. And then once it reaches a boil, I throw in a cup of wild rice, reduce it to a simmer, and within about 20 minutes, it's basically done. And I think it's pretty foolproof. You'll know it's done when the kernels start to curl. I generally like to eat it when they start to curl you know, they don't make a complete circle. They're maybe, they'll curl, how can I explain this, almost a half circle.
Yeah, and it's got a real interesting, chewy, nutty taste to it.
Yes, it does now. And I've had wild rice, people have made it, again, that's that same basic recipe, but adding a can of cream of mushroom soup. And I have to tell you, I think that tastes pretty good. my grandmother would make wild rice soup with the, we usually used pork hocks. And so she would boil the pork hocks until smoked pork hocks, by the way, and until the meat would fall off the bone, and then add the wild rice, and the wild rice being the quicker cooking component of that dish. And so there was a lot of fat in there, which I really enjoy that cooking method. I mean, I really enjoy that way of eating it. I also, at home, because my wife doesn't want me eating pork hocks, so I use chicken, and we use free-range chicken. And, you know, I normally use the parts of the chicken that we don't eat, or, you know, leftovers. But I've also bought chicken breast, you know, really good boneless chicken breast, and use that to make wild rice soup also.
So we're almost out of time now, of all things, but what one chapter of your book focuses on maple syrup. Talk to us about what you call making sugar bush.
Oh, that's in the spring when the days get up to about 40, 50 degrees, I guess, and then it goes back below freezing at night. I think down to 20 is the best time. And it causes the sap in the maple trees, you know, first to thaw and then to rise up into the, you know, up into the tree. And so you're kind of diverting that life force, that juice, that almost the blood of that tree, collecting it, and then you boil that to remove some of the you know, a lot of the excess water, and it's very sweet. I don't know. I love maple syrup. I love maple syrup candy. We grew up with that. It was a very traditional thing. And again, it's a time of celebration. It wasn't like, oh dear, today is the day that we have to perform the sacred maple dance. It was an impromptu, spontaneous coming together of people that really liked the food. I mean, it was this food. Then, you know, we would have, oh God, I don't even know how many quarts or gallons were put up, is how they describe that, are put up or made. But it was also spread along many different family members who participated. So it was a big deal.
We only have 30 seconds left, Thomas. What is what would you like to leave our listeners with, a takeaway regarding how we can value food?
Go to the grocery store and buy it, and smell it, look at it, you know, get your fingers on it, take some time and cook it, and you know, cook it in front of your family and with your family. Let's make it more valuable than what we have made it.
Thank you so much for being with us. Thomas Pecorwiso is the author of Good Seeds, a Menominee Indian Food Memoir. Thank you to Brianne Chasso and to Kai Burrito for producing this hour. Thank you for listening. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network.